and the many fun aspects that that brings. The start of this story is that at one point I was in undergrad, and I was in this machine learning class. It was the first machine learning class I had ever taken. And I was working on this LastFM dataset, trying to build a recommender system, because I've always thought it would be really cool to build a computer algorithm that could help you sort of overcome information overload. And I thought this would be a cool way to try that. And so I started working on this little algorithm thing, and I was feeling pretty good about it, feeling all tough. And then I walked into my professor's office, and I said, "Hey, you're not going to believe this. I have a 99% accuracy rating already. I barely even started." And he, you know, just sort of doesn't react like I want him to. Like, I want him to be like, "Wow, you are a prodigy. This is amazing." But what he does instead, he says, "Okay, well, tell me a little bit more. Like, what's the base rate of your problem?" And I say, "What was that? What's the base rate? What is that? And he says, "What would happen if you just predicted the most common class for everything? Like, what if you just said nobody listened to anything?" So I tried that, and it turned out that that's exactly what my algorithm was doing. It was just saying, nobody likes anything, nobody listens to anything. And we're getting a 99% accuracy because there's so many artists in the world, and there are so many people in the world, that the intersection of that is going to be pretty small. So I was very sad about this, and eventually, you know, found a solution. But the frustrating part about it was I kept running into this over and over and over again, this problem of class imbalance. So this is a talk that I wish I had when I was in undergraduate school, before I walked into my professor's office and made myself look really stupid. I wish that I could have seen this. So before I get into that, I do work for Indeed. Every Indeed presentation has this slide in it that says we help people get jobs. If you like the idea of helping people get jobs, come talk to me. Today we're going to talk about class imbalance. This is the way in which we're going to do that. We will start off with just like what is it, and then we'll move on to how to figure out when it's happening, then talk about some solutions for it, and then at the end I have some like recommendations that kind of sum everything up and try to tie like a nice intellectually tasty bow on this sort of package, because there's going to be a bunch of stuff. So let's start off with what even class imbalance is. So class imbalance happens when you have certain values of your target variable that are way more common than other values. For instance, this is a wine classification data set. You might notice that there are orange points and there are blue points on this graph, and the orange points are way outnumbered by the blue points. And we can say that this data set exhibits class imbalance because there are way more blue points than there are orange points. So there's a lot of things that can cause class imbalance, and we're just gonna walk through them because understanding them will help us understand the solutions better. The first thing is that there's just a lack of data. So this is a made-up thing I have, and let's say you have two features, one of them is on the x-axis and one of them is on the y-axis here, and then you have some points that are orange and some points that are blue. It's difficult to know, is the blue region, like the true blue region, is it defined by sort of like an ellipse that covers both of these? Is it defined by a rectangle that covers them? Like, are there two separate ellipses? I don't know. There's just not a lot of data to really be able to infer that from what we have here. So that's part of the problem with this. Another thing that can be problematic is overlapping. And this is from a paper, I believe, by Batista, where he talks about, he and his co-authors talk about the fact that sometimes, even if you have heavy degrees of class imbalance, so if you look at sort of the bottom right of this screen, there is an imbalance here, and you have way more blue points than orange points, but you can still draw a linear separator between these two things. So the problem isn't actually that bad, really, because like you can still separate them just fine. And so the problem only becomes worse when you start overlapping. And that's when you start to see these things more toward the top left, that these points would be difficult to determine or distinguish from one another. Noise is another important factor in why this happens. You can imagine that we have some blue region that is some set of points. In real world, you don't observe these regions, but for pedagogical reasons, go with me. So we have the blue region and the orange region. We got some points, way more blue points than orange points. And just by the sad law of large numbers, or our instruments being off or something, we measure these ones noisily. Like we accidentally think that these points are way higher than they actually are. And that means that we are going to incorrectly think that this is part of the majority class region, part of the blue region, when in truth, it is part of the orange region. It's just that because there were so many more blue points that we saw, we had a much better shot of reading some points noisily in that area, and they just got overwhelmed. The one that I think is the most well theoretically justified is this idea of biased estimators, and this figure comes from a paper that I have linked at the end of the slides. Also, the slides are there's a link to the slides at the end of this, so don't worry about like taking pictures or whatever. So this figure comes from a paper by Wallace, Small, Broadley, and Tricolinos. It's called Class Imbalance Redux, and it's this like really beautiful theory thing that they present. And this is kind of the crux of their argument is in this figure. What they have displayed here is a binary classification problem in two dimensions. So just along the x-axis here, we'll say that's our one feature. And then if it's an x, it's a minority class point. And if it's a square, it's a majority class point. And we can see there's a lot more squares than x's. And what they find is that you don't actually have one distribution that you're drawing all the points from. You have two different distributions that you're drawing points from. And you happen to see some from the majority class a lot more often. So you're sampling a lot more out of this orange distribution than you are out of the blue one. And ideally, in the greatest world where we could see where these distributions lie, we could draw this beautiful ideal separating line, and it would perfectly, to the best of our ability, separate these two areas. But because we have a class imbalance problem, the line gets biased toward the minority class. It gets pushed in the direction of the minority class. And that means that we're going to accidentally cut off some of that region that should be part of the minority class and incorrectly allocate it to be part of the majority class. So those are causes. Let's just take a deep breath. Okay, how do you recognize this? The first thing, just look for it. Like, call dot value counts. Just know that it's happening, because like first time I ever ran into this, I didn't even think to check for it. I just assumed stuff. So don't make assumptions. It's a bad idea. The next thing you should do is compare stuff. This is a trick question, everybody. 97% accuracy. Is that good? Does anybody think? Anyone? If you okay, yeah. Yeah, it's I mean, when you compare it to this, it's like 97% for our fancy classifier, but 94% for our really dumb classifier. Then it looks a little bit less impressive. It's like, oh, we actually had an improvement of 3%. So one thing that you can do and that like scikit-learn provides is this API for a dummy classifier. And you can have it do a bunch of stuff. You can have it predict the most common class or just predict something at random. But I would highly recommend that when you run into a class imbalance problem, or really whenever you run into a problem, train a stupid classifier that you can use to compare metrics and just sort of sanity check yourself. And this is like, just look at them next to each other and you'll realize, oh, 97 isn't good, because 94 you can get by guessing. This is the code for how to do that. Basically, you just like import the stuff, and then you call fit and predict just like anything else, and you can look at the numbers and see for yourself how you're doing. So part of the problem with class imbalance, so far all we've really talked about is accuracy, and that is a huge part of the problem that we have, is that accuracy just assumes that every error is the same, which is often not true. So let's use a medical example to really make this concrete. You can imagine that we might be scanning someone's brain for cancer, and we have images of malignant tumors and benign tumors, and we can make a mistake on either one. If we make a mistake on a benign tumor, that means we tell the patient, hey, we think your tumor might be cancerous, we're gonna need you to come in for some additional tests. And there is a cost associated with that. Like, they are going to be worried, and their family is probably gonna be worried, and they're gonna have to pay more for the extra tests, and your staff is gonna have to run the extra tests. Like, there is a real cost there, but it is very different from the cost of making a mistake in the malignant case. If we see a malignant tumor and we accidentally say that it is benign, we're gonna send someone with cancer home and say, oh, you're good, don't worry about it. And then they're probably gonna die because they didn't get additional screening. And that's obviously terrible. So what this means is that if you use accuracy, you are implicitly saying that the death of a human person is exactly as bad as calling someone in for additional tests. And that's obviously absurd. Yeah, do you have a question?
You both can be incorrect.
Yeah, you can be incorrect in like both ways, totally. So one set of metrics that people often like to use is precision and recall. So on this little diagram here, we have some false negatives and true negatives. What this means in our medical example is that for precision, what we're saying is, of all the tumors that I see that I say are malignant, how many of those actually turned out to be malignant? And then recall is saying, of all of those malignant tumors in the world, how many am I actually correctly identifying as malignant? And recall is sort of a way of knowing, like, am I pulling back out? Am I recalling the points that I particularly care about? Another set of metrics that you should use rather than accuracy is the receiver operating characteristic curve. The gist of how you do this is you, most classifiers can give you some sort of probability or decision function, and then you can vary a threshold from 0 to 1 and then calculate true and false positive rates and you put them on this curve. This is nice because it lets you sort of think about how good is this model for various levels of a threshold, and it sort of tells you implicitly about how well your model is ranking points against each other. And this is a method recommended by Sina and May in their paper about R-seekers, and they find that when you don't know how bad the two alternatives are, it's really good to use an R-seeker because it sort of you aren't required to know those things in advance. So for instance, if you don't know, is it worse for a user to see a job that they don't want to apply to, or is it worse for a user to not see a job that they do want to apply to? It's like kind of hard to figure out, like, oh, one of those is twice as bad as the other. If you don't know, it's often a good place to use the area under the ROC curve. The last thing I will note on metrics, when you are calculating metrics in, do you have a question?
Does that imply that you know a way to fix that if you do know the cost?
Yes, we will talk about that in a little bit. If you do know the cost, there are techniques that you can use for sure, and we'll talk about those in a second. So the last thing I'll mention on metrics is to be really careful with the way that you do your training and testing splits. So there's this really interesting paper that I didn't have time to put into this because it came out this year. But it's by, like, the lead author is a person named Luke, L-U-Q-U-E, and it's linked in the slides. And they do some really rigorous research on the way that various metrics are affected by imbalance and changes in imbalance. And the gist is that a lot of the metrics that you care about are probably going to be very different just based on the prevalence of the minority class. So if you just by random happenstance happen to get a test split where there's 5% of the minority class versus one with 10% of the minority class, you're going to see dramatically different error numbers for those two different things. And that's not necessarily reflective of some sort of underlying truth. It's more of a reflection of the bias inherent in certain metrics. So what I would highly recommend you do is when you're doing training and testing splits, do a stratified split where you make sure that you have a very similar prevalence of the minority class in each area, in each split. Okay, that's a lot of stuff. Let's talk about how to solve this problem. There's a lot of different things you can do. The first thing you can do is kind of like eat your vegetables. Like, everyone knows that it's a good idea to eat your vegetables, but like, I was eating tamales, you know? I know that I need to eat more spinach. And I know that it's good for me, and it's gonna make me last longer in life. And that's kind of what this is. Gathering more data is kind of the eat your vegetables. It's like, this is gonna help you. It's good, but it kind of sucks. So if you can't do that, or if you don't want to do that, there's a bunch of other techniques that will actually be the bulk of this discussion. This is sort of a taxonomy that is described in this really good survey paper by Branco, Torgo, and Rivera, where they talk about three different ways that the research has kind of thought about addressing this problem, those three being pre-processing, special purpose learners, and prediction post-processing. So we'll go through each of those in this little chunk here. First, pre-processing. When we talk about pre-processing, we are basically talking about taking our data set and either making more points or making fewer points, and like changing the distributions of these things versus each other. So we're going to talk about oversampling first. In oversampling, what you do is you take the data set that you have and you make more minority class points. You can do that in a number of ways. The first way that I have up here is random. You just like take some points and you just duplicate them in your data set. It's difficult to see that that's happening because these points are all on top of each other and this is in two dimensions. We don't have our fancy 3D glasses to be able to, you know, zoom into this. But in the other examples, you can see more clearly what's going on. Where in Smote, for instance, they're creating new minority class points. So Smote is a technique that is used for oversampling of the minority class, and this is sort of the algorithm of how you do that. What you do, you take some minority class point, and then you find its k nearest neighbors, which you can you know, hyperparameter search to figure out what the optimal value for k is. And then you pick a point that is some percentage of the way between those points. So you're interpolating points to make new points is the idea. And you keep doing this until you reach the level of balance that you want. The way that you choose the point, the way that you choose which of your neighbors to interpolate between matters, and that's an area that has been researched further. The original paper just did it randomly, and that's what this smoke diagram is here. But there's been like updates and further research on this where people tend to find that Adison is a really good alternative, where instead of just picking randomly, you try to pick points that are closer to the decision boundary. And so you can kind of see that there's a lot of points on this smoke diagram toward the bottom. And it's like, we already know that the bottom is blue on this diagram. Where we might need more help is when you're getting closer to those orange points up toward the top. And that's what Adison tries to do. You can also go the other way. So that's an oversampling idea. Yeah, did you have a question?
Yeah, so in the oversampling case, right, ideally creating synthetic data, right?
Mm-hmm.
More data that's for the minority class. So how is it really going to affect the decision boundary? Because the decision boundary is going to stay as it is because you're just creating more data for the minority class.
Yeah, I have some diagrams that I can use to explain this in a sec. The gist is that thing we were looking at earlier with the two sort of lines and the line getting pushed toward the minority class. When you have more of those minority class points, they're able to sort of fight back and push the point, that separating boundary away from that. And there, I'll have some diagrams I can show you in a sec.
Okay.
So undersampling is the other way you can go. And coming back to our idea of noise here, I want to remind you that if we zoom in on this little section, we're going to see these two points next to each other. And the insight of this particular technique is to say that if we have two points right next to each other that are of different classes, we probably measured one with noise. And this, I'm gonna be honest with you, is a total like heuristic, like not data back thing. It's just like, probably, you know, probably. So in Tomek links, when you're using them as an undersampling technique, you just take the one from the from the majority class and throw it away. You're just like, yeah, that one's probably not legit. Let's just not care about it. And so that's an idea that you can do. The other thing you can do is way simpler, which is just randomly throw away points out of the majority class until you get to some closer approximation of balance. And that's actually what the Wallace paper argues for. They find that these green lines here are sort of what happens when you undersample to get to a balance point. You can do that in a number of different ways, and you can see that you get a lot of different planes. Like if you happen to throw away a certain point, you could end up drawing your plane in a different spot. And so that can lead to different amounts of error in each plane. But the nice thing is that all of these planes are less biased than the original one that we inferred. So like this purple line that I have here was our original biased estimator, and all these green ones are at least less biased than that. Now it does suck that the error metrics are going to be different for all of them, and in the face of this variance, the authors just suck it up and they're like, all right, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna bag things together because bagging is a great way to trade off bias and variance. And we're just gonna like, you know, sell some bias and you know, gain a little bit on our variance term. So you can take your data set and undersample it in a bunch of different ways and then bag and classify it together and get a more performant model. If you're gonna do any of this, I highly recommend this, and if you are using Python, then use Imbalanced Learn because they implement a lot of this stuff for you. Okay, whew. Another deep breath. Pre-processing is great and it's not so great. So let's talk about when it's good, when it's bad. It's great because the libraries already exist for a lot of this stuff, which is nice. It also kind of like gets the model closer to what you're looking for. It undoes some of that bias that we see from the sort of Wallace paper. Now, this isn't really a good or a bad thing, but it does change the cost of training your model. So if you imagine that you have so much data that you can barely fit it on your computer, if you're gonna start oversampling that data, you're gonna have too much data and you won't be able to train your model, or even it's just gonna make your model train longer. By contrast, if you are undersampling data, you're probably going to have faster model train times because you have less data. So that's not really a good or a bad thing, it's just something to be aware of when you're doing this technique. Now it can be kind of difficult to apply this, because you don't always know what level of balance you want to get to. Like, should I go to, you know, where it's instead of 1%, it's 20% of the data set? Should I go straight to balance? It's not always clear, and you kind of have to explore that and experiment with that to figure out what the right thing is. A second way this can be difficult to apply, if you think back to that smoke example, that was kind of dealing with real valued or floating point numbers. You can imagine if we had categorical data, it would be kind of difficult to do that. And that's when, like, if you're doing word count vectors or something, like, what does it even mean to have 0.7 of the word apple in a document? It's like, what does that even mean? So there are things to try to, there are sort of adaptations of the algorithm to deal with categorical data, but they're less intuitive, I'll say. Okay, next up on terms of various solutions to this problem, special purpose learners. You've probably already seen this if you have looked at the documentation for any of your libraries. I just went through and found some of my favorite algorithms and copied the sort of doc string or the documentation and highlighted a bunch of these have a way to sort of specify a class weight. And what this is doing is depends, you know? Various models do different things. So in tree models, what this is going to affect is, first of all, the impurity calculations. So when you're going through and trying to figure out what feature should I split on, the impurity calculations will get weighted based on the weighting that you specify. The other thing it'll affect is voting time at prediction. So if, for instance, you say that our minority class should count for twice of the majority class, then if you get to the bottom of your tree and you get to a leaf, and there is one majority class point and one minority class point, the minority class point will win because it has two votes, and the majority class point only has one vote. It's, you know, it's different in different places. For SVMs, what this kind of does is push the hyperplane that it learns away from the minority class, and this is cool because it kind of does the same thing of undoing the undoing that bias that the Wallace paper talked about, and they find actually that doing this weight-based minimization is very similar to doing like an oversampling technique. Does the same thing in logistic regression where it just sort of wins back some points for the minority class. In K-nearest neighbors, it changes the distance metric. And in like whatever else, it changes whatever else. Like every different algorithm, weighting the minority class is gonna do something different. I mean, that's you know, cool because there's all sorts of interesting things you can go off and learn about, but it also sucks because it means there's all sorts of interesting things that you could go off and learn about. So instead of talking about every single different thing that class weighting does, let's talk about when this works and when it doesn't. So that way, if you're into this situation, you can think, okay, should I do class weighting here? So the research that I have read finds that when you have a really high degree of imbalance, weighting is less effective. This is from that Wallace paper, and they basically just say, like, when you have a lot more imbalance, the chance that using this weighting technique is going to work is just less effective. And it's going to be more effective with more data. This is where the whole eat your spinach thing comes back in, because more data is always going to make this better. And they have a, like, actual, like, really good theory-backed like equation theory of imbalance that they draw this reasoning from. And I'd highly recommend you go read, if you're gonna read one of these papers, it's the Wallace one, in my opinion, because they have really interesting stuff to say. So good things, bad things on special purpose learners. We're sort of 2/3 of the way through these right now. Yeah, do you have a question real quick?
Yeah, so I confused with the Wallace slides. So if I have more data, if I have lots of data, mm-hmm. which is highly imbalanced, so it's weighting because I mean, saying like if you have more data, then weighting is effective, but if
right.
you have imbalance, then weighting is not effective.
Yeah, so
what if I have both of them?
Yeah, so the question sort of being, if I have a lot of data and I have highly imbalanced, like what is it going to be good or not? And I think like Wallace doesn't really make an argument for what happens in both cases. It just says that for a fixed value. They say that for a fixed value of imbalance, so let's say you have a data set where only 1% is in the minority class, if you just get more points, class weighting will start to become more effective. And then it will also say that if you have a given data set size, and one data set happens to have 10% versus 1%, the 10% data set is going to have better results from using class weighting. Okay, good things, bad things. Good things, it directly addresses the issue. bad things. You have to still know, like, what is your cost benefit here? Which points do you care about more, and how much do you care about certain points more than other points? It's nice that this works when you have a lot of data or when you are a little bit closer to balance. But if you don't already have this class weighting idea in the algorithm, it's gonna suck. You're gonna have to, like, really get a deep understanding of the algorithm, maybe write your own implementation of it and figure out, like, okay, what part of this algorithm is suffering from bias and how can I undo that? And that's difficult to do sometimes. Okay, so the last kind of group of techniques that they talk about is prediction post-processing. And there's two things that I want to talk about here. First is threshold selection. So oftentimes when I run into a class imbalance problem, my first thought is, can I just turn this into a ranking problem and not have to worry about this so much? Where you might think of something like, I want to send an email that has 10 jobs to a user, the 10 jobs I think they are most likely to like. In that case, you know, the user probably only likes 0.1% of the jobs that you know about because they work in an industry. But you don't really need to worry about that too much if you can rank the jobs against each other. And if one has a, you know, 0.05% chance of them liking it, that will rank it above a lot of the other stuff. And so you can pick the top 10 in terms of whatever criteria you have. If you can't do that, though, it is foolish to just use the default threshold that scikit-learn gives you. So you should very specifically choose the threshold that you want to use to optimize your metric. So if you have to specifically pick a number of, like, what percentage chance do I need to choose where above that point I'm going to call someone back for their cancer screening, you need to pick that number really carefully. The gist of how you would do this is you would get the probability output of your model and then figure out what metrics you care about. I put precision and recall on these graphs because we talked about them earlier, but you can use whatever it is, the metric that you happen to care about. And you want to vary that threshold and measure the various metrics that you care about. And you can then look at this and make an informed human decision on what you want to do. So we can imagine, in this brain cancer case, we are probably willing to sacrifice precision for recall. We are willing to accidentally call some people back that are just fine because we would rather do that than let someone who has cancer go unknown. But there's other cases where it's exactly the opposite. Like, if I am trying to like fingerprint into my phone, the cost of me missing it is, like, I get a little annoyed, but the cost of someone, you know, getting into my phone and that not being actually me is a lot, because they're gonna get in there and they're gonna read my memes and tell me they're not funny, and that's gonna hurt my feelings and I'm gonna have to go to a therapist. One last note on this, don't use your test set to do this. Like, do some sort of, like, cross-validation thingy over your training set, but don't use your test set or else you'll overfit your test set, and that'll be really sad. The other post-processing technique that people talk about is an idea of cost-based classification, and this more directly gets to this idea of there being direct costs for a false positive and a false negative. There's a couple papers here. We're just going to talk about the Cena and May paper, where what they essentially find is when you have an ROC curve, each point on that will correspond with some sort of threshold. Like, that's the threshold for, you know, 0.64. You know, if there's a 64% chance of this person having cancer, we'll call them back, right? And we have a true positive rate and a false positive rate. We can use that to calculate cost with this formula. It's not as scary as it looks. The gist is we take the probability of it being in the negative class and multiply that by the cost of a false positive, and then multiply that by a number we can read off of the ROC curve. And then we read, basically we do the same thing but for the positive class. So we figure out how big is the positive class, what is the cost of making a false negative, and then read this number off of the ROC curve. So then we can sort of add all this stuff together, read these numbers off, and the, sort of these orange numbers here I have put in to signify we have a case where the minority class is 10% of the data set. And then I have had these blue numbers in here to say that a false positive is 5 times as bad as a false negative. If I happen to know that a priori, I can plug these numbers in. We can calculate these values of cost for different thresholds and then choose the one that is the best one. And in this case, it happens to be 0.64. Yeah.
So if going back to the equation really quick, am I correct in understanding that the costs if they can be expressed in relative terms, any set of integers or floats that have that relationship works. So you don't necessarily need to express the costs in real life. You can just say a false positive versus false negative is x times more or less costly.
Yes, you're exactly correct. Yeah, this formula these don't need to be real life costs. They could be if you happen to know that a false positive costs your company $7 and a false negative costs it $2. You could use that. But if you do, you can also just come up with something and say this is 5 times as worse, five times as bad or whatever, and those can be whatever numbers you want. Anyway, so then you pick the one with the lowest cost, and that's the threshold you use. I want to point out this is different from the idea of special purpose learners. So the first couple times I gave this was a little confusing, and I realized it's because I didn't talk about it. So they're different. The idea of special purpose learners is that you're modifying the algorithm to have this idea of weighting built into it. In cost-based classification, when we're trying to choose the right threshold, we're doing this after we've already trained the algorithm. Or after we've already trained the model. Because of that, this means that we can use it out of the box with almost any model as long as it provides some sort of probability output or some sort of decision function, which is very nice. It means you don't have to go fiddling about with the interior of every single model that doesn't have this baked in. So, good things, bad things for prediction post-processing. It is pretty straightforward. It's just pick the threshold that's the best one. It's a simple idea to explain. And it kind of gets at what we're looking for, which is to try to optimize our metrics for some value. It is also nice that you can use it with almost anything, because most models provide some sort of decision function. A problem is that this is not really studied a whole lot in specifically imbalanced domains. The survey paper that I am referencing for a lot of this, they only found 2 papers that even talked about this, and neither of those were specifically about class imbalance issues. So that's a lot of things, right? Let's talk about just some highlights here, hit some recommendations of what I think based on what I read and what I have done in my life. Here's some things I think about. And I kind of think about this like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You need to have clean air and water before you start worrying about food. And then once you can worry about food, it's now I worry about shelter. And eventually you get 8 rungs up and you start caring about, your therapist calming you down from having bad memes. So the first level here, I would say, is just establish some sort of baseline, train that dummy classifier, train something stupid, and compare it to your actual metrics. Unless you have a good reason otherwise, which you very well might, if you don't know what to use, I would recommend using the area under the RSE curve, because it is unbiased in these situations for a very specific meaning of not biased. The next thing up from that is if you can try using class weights, just try saying that your minority class is a certain amount more important, if your algorithm supports that. And then from there, I would recommend picking your threshold smart. Don't just use 0.5. That's probably not the right answer. It might be, but it probably isn't. Once you get to that, if you're trying to eke more performance out or you're trying to address something else, I would say at this point, start using a random sampling technique. We talked about fancy methods, we talked about SMOTE, we talked about Ptomaine links. The research did not bear those out as being super great. So the Wallace paper actually, they make a really strong recommendations that in almost all imbalance scenarios, practitioners should bag classifiers that were induced over balanced bootstrap samples. And then there's another paper by Batista, Prati, and Modard where they find that random oversampling is really competitive to these really more complex oversampling techniques like SMOTE. Which these kind of seem to disagree, because one says always undersample and the other says always oversample. My way of justifying this to myself is that the Batista paper doesn't take into account this bagging element. They just do undersampling, and so I think there's a lot of variance in what they're seeing because they're not doing this bagging. But either way, just try the random methods first because they're probably good enough. Only once you've tried doing that do I think it makes any sense to start worrying about SMOTE or any of these really complicated techniques. Because really at that point, you probably have a bigger problem that can't be solved by just some fancy algorithm. It's you need to go find more data. You need to figure something else out. Anyway, that is the gist of what I have to say. There's slides available here. My Twitter handle is also here. And I have an email here. Do we have time for questions?
Yeah.
Okay. I can take some questions right now. If you're just shy and you don't like talking in front of people, feel free to email me or tweet at me. Like, I'd be happy to engage with you that way. But yeah, anybody have any questions? Cool. Then we'll just move right along. Thank y'all.